Timekeeper, are you ready? Begin.
Well, that was all very interesting. Ask yourselves, what is wrong with spending eternity in hell? Well, I'm told it's rather hot there, for one. Dr. Craig is not offering an alternative view of morality. Okay, the whole point of Christianity, or so it is imagined, is to safeguard the eternal well-being of human souls. Now, happily, there's absolutely no evidence that the Christian hell exists. Okay, and I think we should look at the consequences of believing in this framework, this theistic framework, in this world, and what these moral underpinnings actually would be. All right. 9 million children die every year before they reach the age of 5. Okay, picture an Asian tsunami of the sort we saw in 2004 that killed 250,000 people. One of those every 10 days killing children only under 5. Okay, it's 24,000 children a day, 1,000 an hour, 17 or so a minute. That means before I can get to the end of this sentence, some few children, very likely, will have died in terror and agony. Think of the parents of these children. Think of the fact that most of these men and women believe in God and are praying at this moment for their children to be spared. And their prayers will not be answered. Okay, but according to Dr. Craig, this is all part of God's plan. Any God who would allow children by the millions to suffer and die in this way, and their parents to grieve in this way, either can do nothing to help them, or doesn't care to. He is therefore either impotent or evil. And worse than that, on Dr. Craig's view, most of these people, many of these people certainly, will be going to hell because they're praying to the wrong God. Just think about that. Okay, through no fault of their own, they were born into the wrong culture where they got the wrong theology and they missed the revelation. Okay, there are 1.2 billion people in India at this moment. Most of them are Hindus, most of them therefore polytheists. Okay, in Dr. Craig's universe, no matter how good these people are, they are doomed. If you are praying to the monkey god Hanuman, you are doomed. You will be tortured in hell for eternity. Now, is there the slightest evidence for this? No. It just says so in Mark 9 and Matthew 13 and Revelation 14. Okay, perhaps you'll remember from the Lord of the Rings, it says when the elves die, they go to Valinor, but they can be reborn in Middle Earth. Okay, I say that just as a point of comparison. Okay, so God created the cultural isolation of the Hindus. Okay, he engineered the circumstance of their deaths in ignorance of revelation. And then he created the penalty for this ignorance, which is an eternity of conscious torment in fire. Okay, on the other hand, on Dr. Craig's account, your run-of-the-mill serial killer in America, okay, who spent his life raping and torturing children, need only come to God, come to Jesus on death row, and after a final meal of fried chicken, he's going to spend an eternity in heaven after death. Okay. One thing should be crystal clear to you. This vision of life has absolutely nothing to do with moral accountability. Okay. And please notice the double standard that people like Dr. Craig use to exonerate God from all this evil. Okay. We're told that God is loving and kind and just and intrinsically good. But when someone like myself points out the rather obvious and compelling evidence that God is cruel and unjust because he visits suffering on innocent people of a scope and scale that would embarrass the most ambitious psychopath, okay, we're told that God is mysterious. Okay, who can understand God's will? Okay, and yet this is precisely that this merely human understanding of God's will is precisely what believers use to establish his goodness in the first place. You know, something good happens to a Christian. He feels some bliss while praying, say, or he sees some positive change in his life, and we're told that God is good. Okay, but when children by the tens of thousands are torn from their parents' arms and drowned, we're told that God is mysterious. Okay, this is how you play tennis without the net. Okay, and I want to suggest to you that it is not only tiresome when otherwise intelligent people speak this way, it is morally reprehensible. Okay, this kind of faith is really the perfection of narcissism. I mean, God loves me. Don't you know? He cured me of my eczema. He makes me feel so good while singing in church. And just when we had given up hope, he found a banker who was willing to reduce my mother's mortgage. Okay. Given all that this God of yours does not accomplish in the lives of others, given the misery that's being imposed on some helpless child at this instant, this kind of faith is obscene. Okay, to think in this way is to fail to reason honestly or to care sufficiently about the suffering of other human beings. And if God is good and loving and just and kind, and he wanted to guide us morally with a book, why give us a book that supports slavery? Why give us a book that admonishes us to kill people for imaginary crimes like witchcraft? Now, of course, there's a way of not taking these questions to heart. Okay, according to Dr. Craig's divine command theory, God is not bound by moral duties. God doesn't have to be good. Whatever he commands is good. So when he commands that the Israelites to slaughter the Amalekites, that behavior becomes intrinsically good because he commanded it. Okay, well, here we're being offered, I'm glad he raised the issue of psychopathy, we're being offered a psychopathic and psychotic moral attitude. It's psychotic because this is completely delusional. There's no reason to believe that we live in a universe ruled by an invisible monster, Yahweh. But it is psychopathic because this is a total detachment from the well-being of human beings. It so easily rationalizes the slaughter of children. Okay, just think about the Muslims at this moment, who are blowing themselves up, okay, convinced that they are agents of God's will. There is absolutely nothing that Dr. Craig can say against their behavior in moral terms, apart from his own faith-based claim that they're praying to the wrong God. If they had the right God, what they were doing would be good on divine command theory. Now, I'm obviously not saying that Dr. Craig or all religious people are psychopaths and psychotics. But this, to me, is the true horror of religion. It allows perfectly decent and sane people to believe by the billions what only lunatics could believe on their own. Okay, if you wake up tomorrow morning thinking that saying a few Latin words over your pancakes is going to turn them into the body of Elvis Presley, okay, you have lost your mind. Okay. But if you think more or less the same thing about a cracker and the body of Jesus, you're just a Catholic. And I'm not the first person to notice that it's a very strange sort of loving God who would make salvation depend on believing in him on bad evidence. Okay. If you lived 2,000 years ago, there was evidence galore, and he was just performing miracles. But apparently he got tired of being so helpful. Okay, and so now we all inherit this very heavy burden of the doctrine's implausibility. And the effort to square it with what we now know about the cosmos and what we know about the all-too-human origins of Scripture becomes more and more difficult. And it's not just the generic God that Dr. Craig is recommending. It is God the Father and Jesus the Son. Okay, Christianity, on Dr. Craig's account, is the true moral wealth of the world. Well, I hate to break it to you here at Notre Dame, but Christianity is a cult of human sacrifice. Okay, Christianity is not a religion that repudiates human sacrifice, it is a religion that celebrates a single human sacrifice as though it were effective. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. John 3:16. Okay, the idea is that Jesus suffered the crucifixion so that none need suffer hell. Except for those billions in India and billions like them throughout history. Okay, this is a stride. This doctrine is a stride, a contemptible history of scientific ignorance and religious barbarism. We come from people who used to bury children under the foundations of new buildings as offerings to their imaginary gods. I mean, just think about that. There, in vast numbers of societies, people would bury children in post holes. People like ourselves thinking that this would prevent an invisible being from knocking down their buildings. These are the sorts of people who wrote the Bible. If there is a less moral framework than the one Dr. Craig is proposing, I haven't heard of it.
That's what I call Goody Goody Friday. Giving you your religion lesson for the day. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, where the corn isn't growing now, but we had a good crop this year. The only trouble is most of it went out of the country or was put into crappy food that's bad for you. Oh, man, I'll tell you. It is the 18th of December, 2015, and it's Freya's Day, and it's She-Wolf Day in the bunker. So anyhow, the She-Wolves will have to settle for Mitch Miller today. Happy days. He used to be very popular with his chorale on TV. On the TV networks back in the 70s. I always liked that stuff, man. I guess that makes me an old-fashioned kind of guy. Well, don't forget to get your donations in for the radio show and for anything else you'd like to donate to. I might even get on a get on a train and go down to the river and get on a gambling boat or something. But your guys are pretty wise to me there. You're not going to give me extra money because you may do a David Duke and blow it all. Yeah. I got a money order back from that was sent out to one of the POWs yesterday. You know, these federal people are either stupid or insane. I mean, they go by the dot and tittle of everything. It's got to be exactly right. They said I didn't do the money order right, and what happened was I put about 5 of 8 numbers right, and the name was right, and the prison was right, but yet they couldn't figure that out, so they sent it back to me, and I had to put the rest of the numbers on there. I'm telling you, federal people, state people, any kind of government people, they're impossible. Number one, most of them are stupid, can't think logically. Well, I promised to tell you about the corpse in the Cadillac story the other day, and I failed to do so. So now I'm going to tell you about it. And like I say, I've had lots of cars in my day, always used and cheap cars. I never spent over $1,500 for a car in my life, and usually it was $500. I think that Cadillac I bought was $700. But anyhow, this friend of mine, he had a ranch out there in California down in the canyon, and he had quite a few interesting people working for him. They were all rebels. But I saw this half limo sitting out there, and it, you know, the limo, you know how long the limos were. Well, this was sort of half a limo. It was bigger than a sedan, but it was smaller than a limo. It had the seat things on the floor in the back that plopped down and so forth like a limo and all that. But anyhow, I'd like to buy that car. And so he said, I'll sell it to you. I think it was $700 he wanted for it. He said, I want to tell you the history of that car, though. He says that came out of Florida. And I said, well, what's the story? And he said, there were two brothers down there in the jewelry business, and they had a lot of money. Well, they got in a fight, and the one brother killed the other brother, and he put him in the trunk of this Cadillac and drove him out to the airport and let him sit there on the airport tarmac. And so he was there, I guess, for at least a week. So you could imagine the stench coming out of that Cadillac. Well, luckily, by the time I got it, there was no stench. But I remember one time after my wife died, I had a date with this gal. I told her the story of that Cadillac she was riding around in, and that was the last time I ever saw that gal. So I guess the ghost of that guy that got murdered is still riding around in the trunk of that car. I don't remember now whatever happened to that Cadillac. I sold it to somebody, and I don't know why. I'm always buying these cars and then selling them after a while. Well, it's time to visit the good old days. They weren't again. The pessimist guide to history. Let's start with this one. 1672, the Black Plague of Naples. Whoa! A devastating outbreak of the Black Plague hit Naples, Italy, killing some 4,000 people before it ran its course. Those fleas were merciless. In 1678, the French fleet sinks in the Caribbean. On the night of May 3rd, a French fleet sent to capture the Dutch colony of Curaçao was wrecked on a reef off Aves Island near contemporary Venezuela. Of the 20 French ships, only 2 escaped the catastrophe, which claimed the lives of the other 1,200 men. A slight navigation error here. Well, that's what happens when you go trying to just get the goodies from the third world people and don't stay home and work with your own race and go off in as mercantilism, trying to go into the other man's tribal area and take what he's got. So you get what you get. 1678, the French fleet. Well, I did that one. 1685, the bloody Aziz. The crime of high treason excited anger of the judge, Lord George Jeffreys, appointed to try those involved in the Duke of Monmouth's abortive rebellion against the England's King James II. Jeffreys took particular delight in cursing and abusing the prisoners, tormenting them with detailed descriptions of the tortures he was about to impose on them. Some were beheaded, but Jeffreys' favorite sentence was to have the prisoner hanged, then take it down while still alive and disemboweled with a sword. And you think ISIS is bad? You think ISIS is bad? Throughout the county of Somersetshire, crossroads, village greens, marketplaces, and even churches were decorated with the Judge Jeffreys' grisly work. As human heads or the quartered remnants of bodies were mounted on poles, one nobleman who protested such cruelty was silenced when a corpse was suspended by chains on his estate. Some 320 of Monmouth's followers were executed, and hundreds of other prisoners were punished by public floggings or whippings. Later, James II fled the country, and Jeffreys spent his last days in the Tower of London. Our Bill of Rights wisely forbids cruel and unusual punishment. Well, it may forbid it, but it still goes on, definitely. Visit any prison in this country, and you'll see cruel and unusual punishment. 1687, tragic blast destroys the Parthenon. Although the rich colors had long since worn away, in 1687 many of the marble statues of the renowned Greek sculptor Phidias still adorned the pediment of the Parthenon, that's a hard word. This ancient temple to Athena that crowned the city of Athens had remained largely intact for well over 1,000 years, but in one instant, the ancient monument to reason and order was blasted to ruins. Turkish armies at the time in control of Athens, at first, had used the Parthenon as a mosque, then later converted it into a gunpowder magazine. In 1687, a Venetian army laid siege to Athens. And during the fighting, an explosive shell landed squarely on top of the Parthenon. Munitions stored there went up in a terrific explosion that tore the elegant stone structure to pieces. Columns buckled, pediments crashed down, and statues were hurled to the ground. Heartbroken, the Venetian general Francisco Morosini later attempted to salvage the temple, but there was little hope of ever restoring it to its previous glory. Modern-day pollution will later break down the rest of it. Well, you see, see what we love to do, our race, and other races too? We like to destroy things, destroy everything. Yeah, we're the great destroyers, but at the same time, some of us are the great builders. In 1690, the Schenectady Massacre. During King William's War, sporadic fighting erupted between the French and English colonies in North America. But in February 1690, a raiding party of 110 French colonials and Iroquois Indians attacked the unsuspecting village of Schenectady, New York, and massacred 60 residents, including 17 children. Many others were taken to Canada. The old joke is that the name Schenectady comes from the Indian word meaning skin neck today. Well, you see, and all these people would probably tell you they're Christians that did all this stuff. And how about that? The country wasn't even formed yet, and these people, white people, were teaming up with the savages, with the Mongols, to kill white people. So there's nothing new about white people teaming up with white haters and killing white people. And that's happened all the time in the West. And it happened all the time in the East. Yeah. I remember reading about Ben Franklin complaining about how the Pennsylvania government in Philadelphia didn't care about the white settlers in western Pennsylvania and allowed the Indians and the Mongols to butcher men, women, and children on the frontier and didn't care. I think it was Franklin or somebody like Franklin that took the bloody clothes off the bloody corpses of the whites in western Pennsylvania, took them to the state capitol, and threw them on the steps of the state capitol. You see, white people not giving a shit about white people has been around for a long time. 1692, the Glencoe Massacre, when William III became King of England, he required that the Highland chieftains, under penalty of death, to take an oath of submission to him and his rule by January 1, 1692. The chieftains of the Scottish MacDonalds of Glencoe, however, was delayed by a blizzard and did not take the oath until January 5th. The king was informed of the missed deadline and he ordered the MacDonald clan eliminated. On February the 1st, the king's loyal Captain Campbell of Glenlyon and 120 of his men arrived at the clan MacDonald, where they were hospitably entertained for 12 days. At 5 a.m. on February 13, however, Campbell ordered his men to slaughter everyone under 70 years old. During the vicious early morning bloodbath, most of the MacDonalds managed to escape into the wilderness, where they were forced to remain in hiding for many months. Of the 150 adult men in the clan, 38 were slain. Definitely not a nice way to treat your host. And definitely not the right thing for white people to do to white people. So I hope you're getting the message here. And that's it for that, and we'll get back to that later. But the biggest amount of killing didn't go on from pillaging and robbing and mercantilism. It went on by because of religion. Nothing causes more of a bloodbath around the world than religion. Well, last week, the Vatican issued a reflection on Jewish-Christian relations, updating its doctrine on the connection between the two religions. The document declares that the Torah remains a binding covenant and a potential path to putting Jews in the right relationship with God. Contrary to what was widely reported in the press, however, it does not forbid or even actively discourage the effort to bring Jews to Christianity, although it makes a point of not actively encouraging it either. Voram Hazoni evaluates the statement's implications. The reflections demonstrate an intense desire on the part of the Church to rebuild the Catholic theology so it as to put an end to nearly two millenniums of Christian hostility towards Judaism. The document, well, why don't they throw the Bible out of the churches then? Or at least the old tear all the Torah out of the Bibles and throw them out. The document repeatedly and explicitly renounces the mainstream medieval view according to which the Christian New Covenant was replaced or supersedes the Jewish people's covenant with the God of Israel. Well, I'm glad to get that straight. These are changes that Jews should obviously welcome. However, it is important to note that the reflection is not an endorsement of the idea that there are two different possible routes to salvation. The commission that authored it thus holds to what Jews must appear to be two irreconcilable and contradictory views. On the one hand, that the Torah is sufficient for a successful life in the right relationship with God, especially when you're going to annihilate every man, woman, and child in Canaan and stuff like that. On the other, I think that's what the Republicans were talking about on when they debated the other night. They want to do it too. On the other, that Christian teaching is a universal and therefore also exclusive way to, of doing God's will. Oh, we must be prepared for the possibility that the church will never be ready to take the step of calling on Christians to refrain from mission and witness directed towards Jews. Well, it's in their New Testament that they've got to convert to Christianity. It's right in there. Because when Jesus comes back and they haven't converted to Christianity, all the Jews in the whole world are going to be killed. People don't talk about that. So, hey, Jews, you better join the Christ Insanity people because they're going to get you. But they got you anyhow before. They got you many times. It's insane. It's all insane. Here's an interesting thing coming out of the religious thing. Europe is rapidly jettisoning its Christian heritage and has found nothing to put in its place of it save the religion of human rights. Well, as it gets rid of Christianity, it obviously means that there are less and less white people because they, the majority of Christians in Europe were white. I mean, you know, wrong or right. The notion of a human right purports to offer the ground for moral opinions, for legal precepts, and for policies designed to establish order in places where people are in competition and conflict. However, it is itself without foundations. If you ask what religion commands or forbids, you usually get a clear answer in the terms of God's revealed law or the magisterium of the church. If you ask what rights are human or natural or fundamental, you get a different answer depending on to whom you ask. And nobody seems to agree with anybody else regarding the procedure for resolving conflicts. So throw out that human rights bullshit. Goes on to say, it was inconceivable in my youth that anyone should voice an anti-Semitic sentiment. Still more inconceivable that he should exhibit violence, contemptuous language, or any kind of assault towards others on account of their Jewishness. This has changed, and changed almost overnight. Of course, people say that it's all the result of bad behavior of Israel. But what is now considered bad behavior is precisely what was cheered on and endorsed a decade ago. The real cause of this new wave of anti-Semitism is the growing self-confidence and numbers of the Muslim minority, a fact that you cannot publicly declare in Britain, still less in France or Belgium, for fear of provoking the charge of Islamophobia and even the threat of legal action. So much for the rights culture, which displays its foundationless character precisely in this matter, for which it should put itself aggressively on display. It is precisely the advocates of human rights as a social panacea who are the most ardent in seeking excuses for anti-Semitism. Yeah, right. Like anything else, it always works out that he who has the most numbers usually makes the rules. And when the Muslims become more than the Christians, they're going to make the rules. They're going to change everything. For instance, in Brooklyn, in New York, the Mennonites have sold a big church there. That was their biggest church, I guess. And I'll bet you anything, within a matter of months, the Muslims will buy that thing, and like they're buying Christian churches all over the place. And, of course, they're doing all of this peacefully. They're not even, there's no war of occupation going on. They're just doing it. Interestingly enough, back in the 40s, I believe it was, Stalin ordered the reprinting of the books by Chancellor Otto von Bismarck of Germany, who was no friend or admirer of Russia. But he was an absolute pragmatist, the man who personified realpolitik, meaning politics based on realism and not idealism. That is a lesson the leaders of the West could sorely use today, who use propaganda slogans claiming ideals and values and as their aegis for every violation of the international law and order in the world, plus employing the spooks in the sky to help them do it. Bismarck understood the political realities of Europe of his day, and once he had unified Germany, he successfully maintained the peace between the great powers for decades through skillful diplomacy, until it was shattered by World War I and he was long gone. There's no question Bismarck viewed the Colossus of Russia as a long-term threat to Europe, but he was under no illusion that aggressively confronting Russia would be insane. He noted that only internal discord could destroy Russia. No external invader can. Well, Tommy says that's why they employed the Bolsheviks from Brooklyn and New York to go over there and do it, destroy it from the inside. It is no coincidence that the Russia-German relations during Bismarck's time were the best that they'd ever been, before or since. Here are the words of Otto von Bismarck to the German ambassador in Vienna, Heinrich VII, Prince of Rus, in Berlin, 3rd May 1888. Quote, "The result of a war against Russia would never result in the destruction of the main power of Russia, which rests upon millions of Russians of the Greek Orthodox confession. Even if separated by treaty, these would just as soon reunite like the parts of a splattered drop of mercury. This indestructible empire of the Russian nation, made strong through its climate, its vast spaces, and its resiliency, would, after its defeat, remain our sworn opponent thirsting for revenge, exactly like France now is in the West. The smashing of a nationality by three great powers has not happened in connection with the Poles in 100 years. The vitality of the Russian will be no less. In my opinion, we would do well to treat them as basic danger against which we maintain protective dikes, but which we cannot eliminate from the world. By attacking Russia, we would only further consolidate it. By waiting, we could possibly witness their internal decay and decomposition before we experience their attack, and that even sooner, the less we hinder them by threats from plunging deeper into the Orient." And that's the end of that. Interesting article. Now, it's interesting that on Max Kaiser, the last show, they're bringing out that this lady, who is the head of the Central Bank of Russia, had taken Russia from the pits up 17% out of the pits in the last few years. Now, that's just exactly opposite of what we're getting here in this country, because I heard American experts saying how horrible shape Russia's in. It's terrible. It's crashes all over in Russia, when in fact they're doing better with their economy than the United States is. And like I say, the central bank has got themselves out of 17% of being in the doldrums. So it's got to be one side's got to be absolutely lying, and I think it's the ones in the United States, because they seem to be the best liars. Here's some more interesting information. For years, the U.S.-directed NATO alliance has made sure that convoys full of food, weapons, and other goods have gotten to the terrorist groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda via the Syrian-Turkish border. Russian airstrikes have massively impeded this service, if not brought it to a standstill. The Russian airstrikes hit one of these convoys in the northwest Syrian town of Aziz, and the Turkish-based newspaper Daily Sabah is reporting the following. At least 7 people died, 10 got injured after the apparent airstrike, reportedly by Russian jets targeting an aid convoy in the northwestern Syrian town of Aziz near the border crossing with Turkey on Wednesday, Strangely enough, this incident wasn't picked up by the Western high-performance press. This is rather atypical, considering both sides are currently engaged in a propaganda war. It almost seems like the USA, NATO, neither don't want to draw attention to this location of this remaining supply line, or B, it is not an aid convoy, but supply truck for ISIS. The Daily Sabah reporter continues, speaking to the Daily Sabah, Serkan Nurgis from the Humanitarian Relief Foundation, IHH, said that the targeted area is located some 5 kilometers southwest of the Ansapunar border crossing. Nurgis said that IHH has a civil defense unit at Azaz, and they help locals to extinguish the trucks. Trucks were probably carrying an aid supplies or commercial materials, Nurgis added. Regardless of what kind of goods were transported, this confirms that the terrorists in the area near the Anakapinar border crossing are in charge. This is where the supply line from Turkey to ICE can be found. Already in November of 2014, the Anakapinar border crossing was mentioned in an article by Deutsche Welle, DW, that described a scene of hundreds of trucks waiting at the border to get into ISIS territory, probably with Ankara's approval. The DW article from 2014 reads as follows. Every day, trucks laden with food, clothing, and other supplies cross the border from Turkey to Syria. It is unclear who is picking up the goods. The haulers believe most of the cargo is going to the Islamic State militia. Oil, weapons, and soldiers are also being smuggled over the border, and Kurdish volunteers are now patrolling the area in a bid to stem the supplies. Already last year, one would have had to ask the legitimate question, if the plan is to destroy ISIS, why didn't the U.S. just bomb the supply route instead of leading operations inside Syria? Because it was de facto never the plan to destroy ISIS, especially if these attacks were considered to be less dangerous and logistics, for the attacks were right there in the area. A Turkish airbase was there. Asking the more obvious questions, would it be enough to place a crown on the lying politics of the West? Why weren't these convoys stopped while they were still in Turkish territory? Why wasn't the driver arrested and detained in Turkey, and the resources of these supplies traced back to their origins? When answering these questions, it's obvious to everyone, even to those who don't give it much thought, that there's a real intent behind this, and that USA and NATO purposefully provided ISIS with supplies, period. Here's where Russia comes in. Every country that wants to fight ISIS will do so on supply lines. This has been an employed military strategy for centuries. Russia bombing supply trucks near the border so that the fewest possible goods can be unloaded and redistributed through other means is therefore logical, because if the supplies make it over one of the controlled border crossings, they will end up in the hands of the terrorists, wherever the area that may be. This development doesn't please the strategists in Washington one bit, and it's probably the reason for the shootdown of the Russian fighter jet. While Syrian and Kurdish forces control the border east of the Euphrates, the Afrin-Jarablus corridor is the last remaining pathway for supplies to ISIS. The Syrian army has also begun campaign starting in Aleppo and has advanced eastwards. Eventually, they will start to swing towards the Syrian-Turkish border at Jarablus. More or less at the same time, the Syrian army began their campaign. Russia began bombing in the area around Afrin and Adana and Aziz to cut off the supply route. interaction between the Russian air raids and the Syrian army offensive on the ground have the potential to get rid of ISIS. This is an unparalleled nightmare for the planners in Washington. Closing this supply corridor would mean that the complete defeat of the terrorists from ISIS, al-Nusra and company, and it would mean the restoration of Syrian sovereignty and the government structure in this area. This could explain the sudden activity of the West in sending special forces to Syria. And as already mentioned, the reason for the shootdown of the fighter jet. In summing it all up, it also becomes evident that the Syrian civil war never really was won. Rather, the terrorists were supported by the West from the very beginning for the purpose of overthrowing Assad's government, as we've written in previous articles. When faced with a terrorist defeat, the sponsors will throw all their political weight behind the terrorists, no matter what it costs. Ultimately, this is proof that the hegemonic ambitions of the U.S. military-industrial complex, the West in this area, in this region, were the reason behind the creation of ISIS. It was never a fight against ISIS. It was the targeted, planned, intentional creation of Islamic extremism in the form of the Islamic State, unquote. So there you go. Pretty important stuff. You don't read that in the New York Times. I think I've told you all about this book before that I've purchased and read, but if not, I'm going to talk to you about it again. The book's by Herman Knell, K-N-E-L-L, and the name of the book is To Destroy a City, The Strategic Bombing and Its Human Consequences in World War II. So you've got the same wackos today wanting to pattern bomb civilian targets. And you heard the Republicans in their debates. That's all they talked about was bombing people. I'm going to read you the introduction to this book. In Europe, the Second World War had come to an end. It was May 1945, and for any German citizen living in the devastating, conquered, and politically extinct Third Reich, the future looked bleak, very bleak indeed. The war had ended with a crescendo of fighting, killing, destruction, and the arrival of victorious allies. The dictatorial regime of the last 12 years had evaporated, and the place was calm. And above all, there were no more air raid sirens howling day and night. During the day, you saw no more of the contrails of the high-flying, silvery U.S. bombers, nor did you have to watch out for the low-flying, disaster-spewing fighter bombers. At night, there was no more droning of the British bomber formations, no sky marked, no flaked, and above all, no more fearing during the day or night that your community would be the target area of these aircraft. Peace had returned, and there was no more obligatory blackout at night, but life was far from peaceful. The whole nation was paying for what its government had done to neighboring nations, to the whole world, and to its own people. For myself, a young man in the late teens, excused from serving in the Wehrmacht, German armed forces, because of the after effects of polio, and therefore at the end of the war, living in my parents' home, there seemed little hope. It was early 1945, and we were surviving in a one-room garden shack on the outskirts of my home city of Würzburg. Incidentally, T.T. says, Würzburger produces one of the best beers in Germany. I know, I drank quite a bit of it. We had been bombed out, or dehoused, as it was euphemistically termed by the British Royal Air Force commanders. We had lost the apartment we had lived in, with all its contents, except a few pieces we had crammed into a garden shack a few weeks before. My father's two businesses were in ashes, twisted lumps of machinery. Yet we had to consider ourselves lucky as compared with other victims of the bombing war and stream of refugees expelled from the eastern states of Germany, We had a place to stay, inadequate as it would have been under normal conditions. We had some clothes, and we had to put some food supplies into the garden house. We each had a bicycle, and even more important, we had a small hand-pulled cart. Our immediate family had survived the war and the bombing. Compared with others, Würzburgers, Germans, and Europeans in neighboring countries, we had not been uprooted. We knew where we belonged, and our safety net was still there. But the place had to be rebuilt, which at the time seemed a hopeless task. There was no radio and newspapers. We had no water, no electricity. That Roosevelt had died, that the German Wehrmacht had unconditionally surrendered, and that the war with Japan was still going on, we found out only by word of mouth. The first few days after the raid of 16 March 1945 were occupied with extracting from the basement of our flat and the basements of destroyed houses of friends, or the still intact houses of friends in the suburbs, the goods and chattels we had stored there. Not all things we had relocated survived the raids, but one was glad to dig out any piece that and put it on that most favorable handcart and pull it many kilometers to our abode. Then there was the drudgery of securing the daily necessities. The water came from a well 2 kilometers away, where one had to line up about an hour for a pail full of water. Food was hard to come by, and when there was some, many people had no money to pay for it. There were no pay envelopes at all, no commerce or industry, and there were no banks from which to withdraw savings. But after a few months, the tap outside the shack delivered some murky water. The power returned for a few hours a day. Some food became available, and life in general improved marginally. Over the precious small radio we had saved, we could now hear our new master's voice, and after many more months, there appeared even the odd newspaper. The news was anything but cheerful. It was filled with accounts of German atrocities, news of the war in the Far East, the statements of the Potsdam Conference, and orders from the military governments of the zone of occupation one lived in. It was the communiques of the Potsdam Conference that depressed me most. Germany was to be spared the Morgenthau Plan, and of course the Morgenthau Plan was to flatten totally Germany and make it a total agrarian farming nation, and they even talked about dropping the atomic bomb on Germany, but they didn't get it perfected in time before the war was over. But the agreements between Truman, Churchill, Attlee, and Stalin did not bode well for the young German who had his life ahead of him. The government of Germany was to be taken over by the Allied Control Commission, which would act as supervising body of the military governments of the four zones of occupation. There were to be reparations, restrictions on all aspects of life from travel to education, and reductions in industry, such as only a few thousand cars per year for all Germany, i.e. no hope for the dream of a young man to ever own one, but at least we were not all to be castrated, as Roosevelt and Morgenthau had tried to convince each other was a measure to secure the eternal peace. The country was not to be reduced to farming only, although the major German farming areas were to be handed over to Poland. The German inhabitants were to be expelled and resettled in the remaining part of Germany. Even Würzburg, destroyed as it was, and surrounding areas overcrowded with dehoused citizens, as they were, had to accept a quota of refugees. The arrival of these unfortunate people who had to leave behind everything, and many of them had died in transit, caused new and additional hardships. The months that followed were harsh. There was little food, little fuel to keep warm, and above all, there seemed no future. Yet by January 46, the Würzburg University reopened by the grace of the local military governor. It offered courses to complete high school matriculation. For me, that was great until one Sunday afternoon in March while I was walking through the rubble-filled streets. An American Army truck took aim at me and ran me over deliberately and left me there with a broken leg and other smaller bones broken. The truck never stopped, and it was some time before people who had gathered around me stopped a passing U.S. Army Jeep whose driver reluctantly brought me to the Luitpold Krankenhaus in the outskirts of the city. What had happened to me was not unusual, as I learned from one of the men with whom I shared the hospital ward. He'd been shot in the head by a U.S. trooper and survived. These things happened in war, especially under foreign troop occupation. It had happened to a young man in Poland in the early 40s. He was run down purposely by a Wehrmacht vehicle and left. The man became Pope John Paul II. My quest for an education was temporarily interrupted. My broken leg healed, though crudely, and by fall 1946, one local high school was allowed to reopen by the military government. I could obtain my matriculation, which I needed to enter a technical university to become an engineer, as I had decided on long before. Conditions improved further, and you could start to think that maybe there was a future after all. Food, fuel, clothing, anything down to a pound of common nails was rationed for or required a purchase permit from some sort of government agencies. But at least, with some luck, some bartering, and lots of patience, one could acquire most of the necessities of life. Electric power had been restored to the livable houses in the outskirts, even to our garden house. A newspaper appeared irregularly at first, but then at least once a week. From the paper and the radio, we were informed that we were all really a bad bunch. Toward the end of the war, the Goebbels propaganda had told us that we were bad because we were not sacrificing ourselves enough to win the war for the Nazis had brought about. Now we were being told that we had done too much to support that evil Nazi war, and collectively we were guilty. The biggest Nazis were brought before the War Crimes Tribunal, Nuremberg. Volumes of books have been written about the event, and to this day expert opinions differ about the justification and the legitimacy of it all. The victors had intended to call the Kaiser and other German military commanders into the dock at the end of World War I. The campaign armistice of 11 November 1918 states that. The Versailles Peace Treaty, signed in June 1919, did not elaborate about it any further. This time the Allies were not to make the same mistake again. Germany's armed forces had unconditionally surrendered, and the very short Reims surrender document of 1945 compared to the lengthy Compiègne document of November 1918 and the Berlin surrender document of 8 May 1945 made it clear that the Allied Supreme Commander could order any measure. Hitler and the Reich President and the Chancellor, or Führer as he was called, was dead. Before his suicide, he had installed Admiral Dönitz, the famed commander of the U-boats, as president, and Joseph Goebbels as chancellor, but the latter had also committed suicide. Legally speaking, based on common international law, there was a German government theoretically in charge of the country, its people, infrastructure, armed forces, and so on. But based on the unconditional surrender, the Allies took the political leaders prisoner on 23 May 1945, issued an international declaration that the German government ceased to exist on 5 June 1945, and that Allied Control Commission had taken over. That was the end of the Third Reich at the federal level. Since at the provincial and local levels, the leaders had also been staunch Nazis, they were sent either to be converted Nazi concentration and POW camps or went into hiding. From May 1945, the Allied military government, as conceived at the Conference of Yalta, was the government of Germany, and what a mess they made of it. One of the few things they could agree on was to bring all war criminals to trial. There was a need to punish the crimes that had been committed in the Far East and in Europe, on the high seas and in the air. Acts had been committed that called for retribution. The legal basis for prosecuting was and has been there since The Hague, Geneva, and other conventions. I have read many publications on the war crime trials, but found little references to these conventions. It would appear that the legal basis for Nuremberg became an ad hoc undertaking defined after the fact. The fallen leaders, irrespective of what they had done to other nations, had forfeited the trust of the German people. They had been constitutionally elected in 1933, but through shams and abuse of constitutional power had established themselves as dictators. They had not only brought disaster to other nations, but to the Germans as well. Their punishment from that standpoint alone was amply deserved. But by looking at the mass graves and the rubble of my hometown, I felt that the leaders responsible for the bombing war should also be made accountable. I decided then and there I would dig into this bombing. I knew little about it then and all its implications, but I was going to study it. And as history is not normally written by the victors, I, as a vanquished, would put down what I thought about it. Let's see here. Let me check how much time we got here. Let's see, maybe a little longer. But by looking at the mass graves and rubble of... I planned to write the facts that the Luftwaffe had bombed Warsaw, Rotterdam, cities of Britain, Belgrade, Stalingrad, and many other places. That the RAF and the USAAF had flattened my hometown when there was no more military necessity for it. I would dig up the facts, then pillorize the planners, leaders, and the men who executed it all. These people should have also been in the docks, if not at Nuremberg, then at least in The Hague, in front of the International Court of Justice. About 25 years before retirement, in the mid-60s, I picked up again on my original thoughts. My family and I were living in England, and on my way to work on the train from Brighton to London, I saw grown over bomb craters next to some of the railway bridges. The area around St. Paul's Cathedral was full of new buildings. I read books such as Arthur Harris's Bomber Offensive, and every time I visited my old hometown in Germany, it looked more rebuilt and, as a matter of fact, better than before its destruction. My interest was rekindled. I began to study the subject. The books I read were, of course, all of the type written by the victors. They glorified the raids and in many cases did not even attempt to justify their campaign. The more I read, the more I became convinced that there was room for some writings from the vanquished, but there were constraints. I had to make a living, and I was working for years far away from my home base in Canada. Not until the mid-1980s did books appear, albeit most of them written by the victors, that threw a more critical light on the bombing subject. There were books by Germans which castigated the Luftwaffe for what it had done, but in typical German self-flagellation were easy on the bombing of Dresden and Hamburg. The worst raid ever, in March 1945 on Tokyo, I only learned about 1 year before writing these books. More books were appearing since 1980, but still there are gaps of knowledge. Some of these gaps can be covered when more closely closed files at the Public Record Office at Richmond outside London will be available. Others when scholars have the time and money to study now available Soviet archives. It became clear to me with the study of available literature that I was faced with a number of problems. Despite the multitude of books published in the last 50 years and the masses of documents available in archives, there is still much research needed to gain an objective view, composing something as a vanquished, as I had thought of in 1945, would be unfair and not objective. Many books have been written on the subject, but most seem to be in essence either praising the wisdom of the results of the area bombing or condemning them. Interpretations can be rather biased, and many books leave out facts which would not support the biased view. Similarly, I found that quoting documents have been interpreted to suit the author's views, which brought me to the conclusion that I may have to look up some documents myself and then arrive at my own interpretation. Two authors went into the background of area bombing or pattern bombing and the political, economic, and military implications as to why this disaster culminated in World War II, and that I could contribute personal experience and detailed knowledge of one of the worst examples of area bombing. These thoughts went through my mind, and my attitude towards the subject changed. In more than 50 years since it happened, I have come to the conclusion that what is needed is an objective assessment. I have long given up the idea of castigating the perpetrators of bombing on both sides of the two world wars, or condemning the bomber crews or the civilians who were mistreated and often even killed down flyers. It was wartime. People were guided by patriotic fervor and were convinced that they were right. The enemy, down to the last citizen, was wrong, and even God was on their side. The bomber leaders were soldiers and all acted in the best interest tradition of their profession. A soldier's duty is to protect his country and defeat the enemy. There are international agreements, and there is a code of ethics, all of which define the conduct of war. Yet war is not merely a matter of fighting. As Clausewitz, the German military philosopher, wrote in the early 19th century, war is the continuation of diplomacy by other means. In other words, there are political implications for war. War costs money, and any responsible soldier leader will attempt to defeat the enemy at the least possible cost. I came to the conclusion that if at all possible, I would see both sides of the bombing war and the victors and the vanquished. The fact that World War I ended over 80 years ago and World War II over 50 years ago had to influence my writing. There was no point in regurgitating old hatreds and misunderstandings that mankind cannot possibly be proud of. What happened was bad. Both sides committed acts which history has since condemned. The bombing wars from 1914 to 1945 are now history. Terrible history at that. Whether historians prove that the bombing, killing, maiming, and destructions did not win the wars, or whether respected military leaders in their memoirs prove that the bombers brought victory, and above all, the economic victory, is, in my opinion, not the point. And mankind must learn from history. Clausewitz may be correct in his theorem, but he does not say what happens when the military have run out of war. Peace is continuation of war. After the military leaders have done their job and have run out of ideas and means to carry on, in the end, the enemies have to live with each other again. There will be interactions again. Foes become allies and even friends. And the best thing for continued peace is to forgive and try to understand the other side. For me, it is, therefore, far more important to understand why it all happened than to point a finger and polarize people and events. It has become history, and let's learn from it. Obviously, we have not done that yet. The bombings in Korean War and Vietnam War and numerous smaller conflicts since 1945 have continued to make the bomber aircraft a weapon well-liked by the military. Worse, the ballistic missiles of the great powers pointed at large population centers indicate that nothing has been learned from the misery between 1914 and 1945. On the contrary, the killing of masses of people, mostly innocent civilians, has become the envisaged ultimate modern warfare. Fortunately, there were enough responsible civilian leaders on both sides of the Cold War to prevent Armageddon. International agreements have been signed providing for the destruction of many of these ultimate weapons, but the technology will always be available. I do not think that Bomber Harris should be condemned. His decision in the morning hours of 16 March 1945 to send Mosquitoes and Lancasters of No. 5 Bomber Group over Würzburg that night has affected me among thousands of others. His decision caused me personal loss and pain in the years immediately after 45. I was ready to prove that there was a war criminal who got away. But as the years have passed, so has my pain, and the loss has passed into history. So has Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Harris. I now want to know why it all happened. What were the reasons behind it? I would wish to judge, but I cannot and do not wish to condemn. The case is too complex. History will be the judge, but the verdict will have to be wait, because the jury is still out. My interest in the subject is to show how a controversial weapon affected individuals and what the many reasons and justifications were for putting hundreds of thousands of civilians on both sides of this war to the sword. What led to the destruction of Wurzburg? And that was the introduction, and he gets into the mechanics of the whole bit. I'll tell you, it's a really, really good book. And I think he is a little bit too liberal at the end of myself. If I was bombed out of my home and everybody killed, I don't think I'd ever forget it. And I don't think I'd ever forgive it either. That's it for today. We'll be back with you Moon's Day. In the meantime, have a great winter solstice. And also the pagan Santa Claus. But I can't join in with you worshiping the Jew on a stick. Bye-bye.